My name is Robert Dennis, and I'm from California. We have no accent in California. It's a standard English. Where's my friend from the UK? I'm sure he would. There he is. I'm here with a colleague, Ki Huang. We're going to talk very briefly about our experiences with the OpenACS and one specific project. My goal is a bit selfish. I give you just enough information you can understand our situation. And then, of course, I'll answer any questions, but I have questions for you. We're here to learn and sort of pick your brains. So the application that we're talking about is called the OATS, or the Outside Activity Tracking System. But before that, let me tell you about ourselves. We're a small group of developers at the UCLA's University of California, Los Angeles campus that work within the School of Medicine. And we've been involved with the OpenACS for a long time, like many of you. I started in 1994. I had a project opportunity working with Navisoft and something called the Illustra database. That's what they used in those days. And then, as Gustav gave you a little history of the Navisoft server, it was purchased by AOL server, and they changed the name to the GNN server, which I think was the Global Network Navigator. We switched to a European relational database management system called SOLID. I don't know if anybody recalls that. And when it became AOL server, it was about the time, you know, we migrated to Oracle. Now, both Ki and I, for a period, worked at Ars Digita in the Pasadena office with our colleagues across the valley up at MIT. But I've never left UCLA since joining it in 1996. So we've got a long history with the OpenACS, and we have grown sort of organically, meaning we have many, many applications that were created over time, so they're not all in one instance, they're many, many instances. So consequently, some of our architecture decisions may be a little different. This is just a sample of some of the things we do. Our group works with researchers in the health science community. So if they have some project, we can work with them to bring some solution. And we're mostly in an area called research data collection management and reporting. Oddly, we have never done a course or a learning management system. You know, we do a lot of research systems, whether it's room reservation or research equipment reservation and scheduling, clinical trials management systems. But the system that I'm talking about today is specific to the University of California. And California is on the west coast of the United States. If you know where the Pacific Ocean is, you go up from Mexico, and that's California. If you know where Hawaii is, you go east, and then that's California. The University of California, it consists of 10 universities or 10 campuses. Six of them have academic medical schools and health science programs. In total, there's over 300,000 students across the fabric, and there are almost 25,000 faculty. And these are the tenure-track faculty, so it excludes the lecturers and whatnot. If you add those, it's another 70,000. The OATS system is an administrative system which allows the faculty at the Universities of California to comply with policies about conflict of commitment. And so this is probably different from many of your experiences, but University of California is a public university system, and there are policies that the faculty have their primary responsibility or obligation to the university. So if you're a professor in engineering, your responsibility in that area is primarily to the university. If you're going to do some consulting outside of the university, there are procedures you must go through. So you must request some permission depending upon the type of outside activity. So this is what the OATS system is designed to support, but it's important to understand that the University of California is 10 universities. Each university is separate and independent. They have their separate faculty, separate administration. Each campus has their own priorities. At the state level, there are these policies, so that's common. Now, the way we've implemented this is one application, each campus has a subsite. The policies governing conflict and commitment don't prohibit engaging in industry or outside of your university responsibilities, but it puts some limits on it. So you have a number of hours that you can engage in outside each academic period. If you're in the health science, there's a limit on how much money you can earn from your outside activity. Beyond that amount, you have to pay it back to the plan, where it gets taxed, and ultimately it's returned to the faculty through certain means. So the system is role-based, and I'll show you very briefly what the roles are, but basically it's faculty who report their outside activities, and then reviewers and approvers who are responsible for giving permission or making sure that it's compliant. And then, of course, there are auditors. So it's a workflow-driven application. We did not use the OpenACS PetriNet workflow. We used our own, which is much simpler. It's based on the finite state machine, and it's just a little lighter weight. This is a system of record, so it's a quasi-legal repository of information. Some of the requirements are that it has to be highly reliable and available for each campus. So our goal is to really have zero downtime. So these are an example of some of the roles and the workflows that are involved. You know, if you are engaging students in an outside professional activity, maybe you're beginning a company and you want your graduate students to get some experience and you want them to be involved in the company. As a faculty member, I need to declare that and make sure I get permission. If I'm starting another company outside of the university, I have to submit that and get permission before I start. So this is an example of some of the different forms that are generated. The object that goes through the workflow is a form, and the only point of showing you this is that these are very complicated and fully articulated workflows. This is just one section of it. DOT won't show the whole thing. It renders it several pages wide. That's my only goal of showing you that. So that's some of the general requirements of the system. I want to talk about some of the infrastructure decisions. Historically, for 20 years, our group maintained our own servers. And, you know, this is pretty typical of the server rooms. So for 20 years, we have our own equipment, our own network connection. And then in 2015 or 16, there was a big event that changed everything for us on the campus. There was a breach of data, and not our group, thank goodness. One of the professional schools, I think the School of Public Health, had a Microsoft SQL server that was compromised, and hackers came in and stole, you know, tens of thousands of patient records. And there are some very serious laws and consequences for that. So the university was looking at per case, per patient penalties of around $5,000, and there was over 100,000 patients that were exposed in this case. So it changed the environment at UCLA and across the UC campuses. We had to surrender our weapons of mass dissemination and give up our servers and close our connection to the campus backbone and join a larger IT organization that put security first. So it was a big game-changing event for us. We went from on-premise to the cloud. So this is a schematic of the cloud architecture that we have to operate in. You'll notice that on the far left, it's a segmented network design, so that on the far left, where the database resides, it's the most tightly protected environment. So there's only specific protocols and on specific ports from very specific IP ranges that are allowed access. Nothing else gets in. In the center is the medium protected, where the application runs. So this is where the Navi server runs, and it's a little bit more open, but it's the only one that can talk to the database. On the right side, this is a semi-public subnet. It's not really open to the public, but this is where the proxies are, but in our case, it's a load balancer. So this is the endpoint, which then goes to through a dedicated VPN tunnel back to the campus, where there's web application firewalls and next generation Cisco Palo Alto firewalls there that protect it before it gets to the internet. So we have very limited choice in this. This is the environment that we have to work in today. And we have three of these, one for development, one for test and staging, and one for production. So which brings us to how we've made some decisions in the OATS application. Remember, there's 10 universities, 10 subsites. We have to have high availability. And a couple of comments about the cloud, and when you go from on-prem to the cloud, the marketing buzzword is elasticity. So in our case, we're in the Amazon Web Services Cloud, and everything has E in the name, all the services. So it's Elastic Compute, or Elastic File System, or Elastic Load Balancer. The notion of elasticity is that you only use what you need at the time that you need it. So you provision things very small, and then like a rubber band, you can stretch it out on some signal to make it grow, and then you can contract it again at some other signal. So that signal can be a time a day, a time a week, or based upon the state of your application. If you get a CPU over 60%, you can elasticize it and scale out to a certain point and then scale back in. So these are the goals. In the cloud, so we don't have to over-provision a system to a high watermark. We make it as small as possible, and then hopefully we can scale out based upon demand. So these are some of the goals. Now, how do we want to do that in the OpenACS? The OpenACS in the kernel section allows you to run the OpenACS in cluster mode. Maybe some of you are doing this or are familiar with it, but a cluster is multiple instances of the OpenACS talking to the same database, so the same schema. This could cause problems, particularly if you've got scheduled procedures and different things that are happening, all talking to the same database, they begin to clobber one another. So you have to have certain rules. And the OpenACS declares if you turn cluster mode on with cluster enabled P to 1, then you define one member as your leader or the canonical server. And then any number of members of the cluster or followers. So leader, follower, canonical, members. And you'll notice that these are static declarations. If you're in an elastic world, you may not know beforehand the IP addresses of a new member of your cluster. So that was a challenge that we had to face. So this is what we're trying to set up. You may have a cluster across, these are the three zones, the database most protected at the bottom now as opposed to the left, the application layer in the middle, and then the egress or the endpoints at the top. So the canonical server runs the scheduled procedures, and then we can have several cluster members that have a responsibility for some of the subsites. So we can partition traffic to some of the subsites. So that's what this looks like. Our approach for managing the dynamic nature of the cluster is we wrote a small, simple package that has a few parameters for dynamically managing the members of the cluster. So if a new member comes into the cluster, it registers its IP address, which gets stored in the database. Then, based upon these parameters, the canonical server that is responsible for making sure that all the members are registered and talking to one another. And the messaging that they do is it's time to clear your cache and continue working. So in addition to this, then there is a little panel that we can go to see where the current members of the cluster here on the bottom. And this has helped us utilize the cluster mode or the cluster capability of the OpenACS. So it's a start in the right direction. I'm going to sort of zip through the rest and get to some of our questions. We're going to share with you some of our current work with CI/CD pipelines and where we hope to get. This is pretty much what we're trying to do in our test environment. We're not there in production where we're trying to utilize containers in the OpenACS world. So let me jump ahead now to our questions so that we can go to lunch. So knowing that we're using the OpenACS in cluster mode, we can, with our little package, we can manage the dynamic addition or subtraction of members to the cluster. But so that's not a problem. But what happens if the canonical or the lead server dies? There is no way we lose the mechanism which is responsible for running the scheduled procedures, and bad things can happen. So this is one problem for us, or potential problem. It hasn't become a problem yet because our strategy is we protect the canonical server from having to serve traffic, and all it has to do is monitor the members and run the scheduled procedures. But that's really not what we're hoping to do. So a question is there a better approach for managing the cluster in a situation where the leader or the canonical server dies? How can we elevate somebody to that role or bring in a new leader or canonical server? Also because of the history, the recent history of the security breaches at our campus, security has become a very hot topic, and as Gustav mentioned, a lot of work his team has done in the OpenACS 5.10 has been driven by some of those. We ourselves have had to endure some of that. So a few lessons that we have learned, and these are our fault or our responsibility, not the OpenACS. don't misunderstand me, but the OpenACS is very open, and rightly so, but when we had our systems tested by vulnerability scans. Third-party outside companies come in and try and attack and break your system or look for SQL injections or cross-site scriptings and various other weaknesses. They went to the OpenACS site after they learned and figured out that we're running Navi Server and running OpenACS. Then they read through the weaknesses because it's open and there's lots of information. And they discovered that, well, lots of things are open to the public, meaning your default installation, for example, API-doc. Anybody can go there. You don't have to be logged in by default. Now, that's our responsibility to have to tighten that up, but that was a lesson learned. Similarly, we learned that the default permissions on certain on packages may be a little too open, and the inherit permissions from main is very dangerous. So the inheriting from the main means that the public has read. So if your permissions are set that way, you're going to expose things that could potentially be used against you. So one of our questions is there a best practice or recommendations that the community can give us for programmatically checking and changing the permissions? For example, could we modify the OpenACS unit tests to also report on the permission settings for each package that it goes through? And perhaps that's an additional piece of information that we could use in one of our pipelines. And then Gustav's earlier presentation about performance tuning, it's something that we desperately need to learn and understand better. You know, we're here to learn your secret sauce for how you run a single instance with 900,000 registered users or, you know, all these thousands of concurrent connections and requests. So it's quite impressive, and we're eager to get to that level. So I thank you, and I want to hear your thoughts.
I mean, you have asked questions. Maybe I can address a few of these quickly. I mean, OpenACS is a framework, and for example, you mentioned here API-doc. API-doc was mostly developed for the OpenACS site, that everybody outside can always see everything what is there, and this is some kind of a documentation. Also, if people have local modifications, they will look, how does it look like in the original version, and they can compare things, they can click around. I mean, it's a documentation instrument. I mean, the best documentation you have about the API is API-doc at the end, therefore, but certainly the needs for installation is different. But it's mounted in a place, you can mount it in a different place, and so on. I mean, it's, from this point of view, it's, I think, easy to manage. That's what you're saying, that default permissions are too open. I mean, for all of the people using .learn, the usual complaint is the default permissions are too restrictive. therefore, it's not so easy to say what is the right defaulting, but I certainly agree that, let's say, higher transparency, what is allowed in which package, up to which degree, having a better, something like a browser should certainly help things for administrators to know what it is. The same thing we shared, who is online. It's very easy to get rid of it or whatever. Just delete the file and it's gone. Many of the things can be certainly tuned, but they have to be tuned. And it's in some way, also if you get a plain OpenACS instance, it looks really ugly. Mm. But up to a certain degree, it looks intentionally ugly because there are themes and you are open to make your own theme and reuse things which are there. Therefore, it's just demonstrating the starter. It's a raw system, and you can do many things with it, but you have to do it in a way. So it's not my idea. It's a history how it developed. I mean, updating permissions, of course, you can do it. I mean, it's just, I'm not sure why you came up with this point, but we can certainly discuss this. And I mean, performance tuning a secret sauce. There's no secret sauce for this. I think the secret, the most important secret is to get monitoring right.
Mm-hmm.
And monitoring works in many aspects. I mean, there's this Navi server monitoring instruments there, but there are also other things here, like there's this request monitor where you get a lot of detailed information of what's going on, what are the peaks at which place, and you can look what is the most frequently used, whatever, URLs on this reason, but it's already built in, but you have to install this package. If you don't know the package exists, you don't use it simply, but from this you get a lot of insights there, and it can also use to dynamically change the behavior. And there are also external tools like Moonin plugins. I mean, there you can get them, just download it and install them, and you get on many details, you get statistics, how was this last week and how it is now, something like this. And if you go to some higher level, just go to the thing of that Thomas presented here, mm-hmm. just Elasticsearch. I mean,
mm-hmm.
it's also very elastic. And I think it's no secret to how to set it up. I mean, it's straightforward. I mean, it's just sometimes some applications add content to the log entries in access log. I mean, access log is extensible, and we have added a couple information there. Therefore, we can give you our configuration. No question about this. And from this point of view, it's very easy to work with. And I mean, putting things always online, everybody expects it works out of the box. Therefore, it's the question is, what are the kind of, let's say, levels there? Just the last single element. I mean, I was quite surprised that you are able to do things with clustering, because clustering was developed, I think, 20 years ago. It's a very old history, and not too many things have changed, but there are also other universities working with clustering. There's a people from Utah State University.
Mm.
They are very much interested in clustering for their application, building clusters with Docker in their case, have also some kind of own problems coming up, and I think it's a good time to team together and come up with something which suits for more installations and get things going. And I mean, we have discussed already, there are many ways also for, there's an intra-server talk, it can be also improved, for example, via UDP. I mean, it's much faster not having for every request there coming up with a fresh TCP connection, and even worse, with a fresh TLS connection. You have a six-way handshake. For every update, it's too expensive.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, there's a lot of place for improving things. There are also new flags in Navi Server for turning off caching altogether. I mean, the same code is running with and without caching, simply by flipping a one entry in the log file. And then, for the people in Utah, they are perfectly happy with the system without all of this caching stuff. I mean, because they're scaling out. I mean, but it's sometimes different of what's going on.
Well, thank you for all of that.
And as you guys are using AWS just to be in the same line of monitoring tools, you have the whole environment that you could run those AWS modules to see what is going on, which will be not the same, but pretty similar to the ones that Gustav just mentioned to you. So it will be a good way to compare, like installing those tools and comparing those with AWS monitoring tools to get a good glimpses of what OpenACS can serve to you. That would be great.
Thank you. Well, lunch.
Yeah.
Thank you for listening and
your input.